All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Sunday, September 27th, 2020. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to The Barnes Review, a bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. All right, with that said, let me introduce our special guest this evening. James Edwards is joining us for the very first time. James is the host of the nationally renowned talk radio program, The Political Cesspool. He's an author and a longtime pro-white advocate. James, welcome to the program, sir. It's really an honor to have you here.
John, it's great to be here. And because of you, we got my Skype working again. So it's a two for two. But big respect to you and the Realist Report, obviously. We share ties and friendships and collaborations with the American Free Press and the Barnes Review, two of the greatest publications running in this country and really in the world today. So the honor is all mine.
Hey, well, thank you. I appreciate it. And I've been a guest on your program, I think, twice now. And yeah, that was quite an honor being on your program. We discussed some of the articles I've written for the paper and, you know, just kind of current events and stuff like that. So it was, you know, it's always great being on your program. I'm glad to kind of turn the tables and have you on my program and actually interview you. So just to get started, can you kind of just introduce yourself and give us a brief background on your involvement in politics? I know you've been doing this for a number of years, and you got started at a pretty young age, probably about my age when I first got started in this. And, you know, that was about 20 years ago for you, if I'm not mistaken. So you want to just give us a brief little background just before we jump into some of the other issues?
Yeah, if you don't mind. I appreciate that. Yeah, so you're right. It was the fall of 1999. I was 19 years old, and I got involved with Pat Buchanan's last presidential bid. This one was, of course, under the Reform Party banner, and I started working for that campaign and got involved with the state effort in Tennessee and became the treasurer of the campaign in Tennessee. And also a delegate for Pat in Long Beach, California, the summer of 2000. I had just turned 20, and I met a lot of great people, some people who really impacted my life in very positive ways, and their fingerprints are really still on my activism and really my upbringing. And that was a big coming-of-age year for me, and after that campaign ended, I didn't want to lose touch with the band. You know, I wanted to keep the band together. And I was looking for other ways to apply myself and to give us something to sort of rally around. So I decided at the age of 21 to seek a seat in the Tennessee state legislature. And I know a lot of third party campaigns. I was an independent candidate running in a three-way race against the Speaker of the House. And a lot of times you put your name on your on a ballot, you qualify for ballot access, and you say you ran a campaign because your name appeared on election day. But that's not the way we did it. I was young and I was eager and I was, I guess, a little naive, but I thought if we worked hard enough, we would win that race. And so we went out to win. We had a campaign headquarters in a little strip mall. We did mailers. We did direct mail. We did advertisements in the local media. The campaign actually got coverage in local media, which is almost impossible to do for the right reasons when you're running a third-party campaign like that. We knocked on every door in the district. We were at carnivals. We were at different civic events in the district. And we were really all over. It was a multi-state effort. A lot of people were coming in to help and to participate in a lot of this outreach. And I remember wearing the soles out of two different pairs of shoes. We really went after it. And, of course, I was disappointed on election day. Of course, I lost. The person that I ran against is now the Secretary of State of the state of Tennessee. But we got 20% of the vote nearly in a three-way race with a 21-year-old independent candidate. I think at the time it was the most votes anyone ever had gotten as an independent candidate for a seat in the state legislature. And so It raised my profile just enough in the local community to where I got a call one day in the summer of 2004. By now I'm 24 years old, and get an opportunity with this new radio station that's coming online. It's reformatting to talk, and they asked if I wanted to do my own show. And that's how the Political Cesspool was started. And almost 16 years ago to the day, October of 2004 was our first night on the air. And I knew I didn't want it to be a standard run-of-the-mill conservative talk show. I didn't want to be the local guy who reads the Republican press releases and fancies himself as the next Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity. I wanted to do something a little more than that. I wanted to serve a higher calling, and I wanted to get out these ideas and guests that are either hushed up, or I think that's actually the American Free Press tagline, that are hushed up or otherwise distorted by the establishment media, and to have my program serve as a platform for dissident ideas and dissident leaders. And I thought, again, being a young man, I mean, in my early 20s still, this is a big country. We're all adults, and some people may disagree. But in the marketplace of ideas, everybody has the right to be heard. Well, it didn't take me very long to dispel that notion. That's not, of course, not how America works at all. But for 16 years, without retreat, surrender, or apology, we're still kicking. And it's still a great time. I'm still very eager to go to work every week. And I love the audience, and I love the product that we're able to get out there, and the way we're able to do it. So it was really that's really the story. It was the three stops on my way to activism: Buchanan, my own campaign, and then the radio show, which has stood the test of time. A lot of longevity there. That as much as anything, I'm proud about.
Yeah, well, good for you, man. And you mentioned so it was originally you said you were in Long Beach for the was it the Republican or the Independent Party?
That was the Reform Party convention.
The Reform Party convention. Wow, that's interesting, because I actually live right in Long Beach. So were you guys at the convention center down here?
I stayed at the Renaissance Hotel. I remember that. And yes, it was at the Long Beach Convention Center, is where the Reform Party had that nominating convention, which, of course, was covered by all the major media. I mean, Buchanan was still able to get news in that campaign, even though, of course, he wasn't able to do nearly as well, obviously, as he did in 1996 running in the Republican primary. But it was still, at that time, the Reform Party was still receiving matching taxpayer funds. So it was a bona fide third party, and it had ballot access in nearly every state. And so it was the last real third party bid that a candidate had fielded. And of course, I've long since, not been a part of the Reform Party anymore. After Buchanan left, that was pretty much the end of it. But it did, play a big role in my development.
Yeah. That's very interesting. And, myself, going back to when I was even in high school and certainly in college, I was always very skeptical of like the mainstream Democrat Republican establishment. I was always interested in third parties. In fact, I remember very vividly, actually, Ralph Nader coming to speak at my university when I think I was a senior in college, and this would have been the 2008 election. And of course, I voted for Ralph Nader, and then in 2012, I want to say it was Ron Paul was kind of like the independent candidate. So I've always been kind of into the independent candidates rather than the establishment politicians who are just total sellouts. And that was very clear to me, as a young man, which seems like it's pretty much the same case for you as well.
Well, I can remember the first time I ever did any media ever. Well, there was maybe a couple of quotes I was able to give as a spokesman for the Buchanan campaign in Tennessee. But the first TV I ever did, it was just a small community access type show. And they were profiling each of the four biggest parties in 2000, obviously the Republicans, the Democrats, the Reform Party, and the Green Party. And I was there as the spokesman for the Reform Party on that particular program. And they had the chairman of the Tennessee Republican Party and the chairman of the Tennessee Democratic Party, and then a representative for Nader. And I just was I still remember that. I mean, we're spending a lot of time. I don't want to come across as I'm a spokesman for the Reform Party now, but going back to my how it all started. But I remember looking around this camera and was like, how in the world did I end up here? Just thinking at that time. But little did I know where it would go.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Since all this has happened, you've had a lot of experience with the mainstream mass media, not only with your campaign, but, kind of branching out and starting your own radio program. And I know you've been on CNN and maybe even Fox News and some other programs. What is it? What's your overall assessment of the mass media and the way they've treated not only your campaign, but also just like the issues that you talk about in general?
Well, I didn't. I don't guess I really even became James Edwards until I started the political cesspool. I mean, that is, of course, what I'm known for more than anything. And of course, I mean, I'm sure my opinion of the establishment media is the same as yours and anyone tuned in to the Realist Report today. Obviously, they're completely controlled. They claim to be proponents of diversity, but of course, there is no tolerance for diversity of opinion within the establishment media. They speak with a single voice on all important issues. And so, they definitely are the antithesis of everything that I stand for and what I want my work to be remembered for. But yeah, I mean, over the course of my career in radio, we've been covered by everybody. I mean, from TMZ and the Hollywood tabloids to Jimmy Kimmel doing a skit on us on his late night comedy show or whatever you call it. And then, of course, I spent a short stint as a commentator on CNN. They would bring me on to for a very short time to talk about different issues. I was on to talk about self-segregation for an hour, actually, which was, extremely rare when you're brought onto a primetime show to serve on a panel debate for a full hour. I mean, obviously they normally have these short hits with different guests, but to be on for an hour was was certainly memorable. And they brought me on to talk about the death of the college couple in Knoxville, Tennessee, and they brought me on to debate the NAACP chairman for that one. And then I was on again to talk about immigration, I believe. CNN was actually fairly nice to me. That was back or courteous, I should say, professional rather. They needed somebody who was fairly articulate and I guess young and willing to come on and talk about these issues, which most people would shy away from. And so that's what have minted us in a way. That was way back in 2007 with the spell at CNN. But yeah, we've been covered by Fox and MSNBC, Washington Post, New York Times several times. Really, just about every major media at some point for some reason has covered the political cesspool and the
Right.
work we've done or some of the things we've
Well,
said. So we were able to break through in that regard in ways that a lot of people, it's hard to do.
yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's interesting because I mean, I remember, you can still find YouTube clips of you on CNN. And this was what, 13 years ago now?
Long
And
time
back
ago.
then, it was certainly much more objective and professional than it than you'd see on CNN today, right? I mean, the media, like to me, and maybe this is something we can get into as we talk about Donald Trump, but the media is so biased and so like obviously so that now they wouldn't even have somebody like you on and treat you professionally and actually like let you speak your mind versus back then, it was a much different story. So the media
Well,
has
I'll tell you,
changed
John,
quite a
just a
bit.
quick anecdote, not to interrupt you, but no, I can tell you in no uncertain terms, obviously the media at large has gotten much worse. It wasn't good by any standard of measurement, even in the mid 2000s. It's so much worse and so much more biased and so much more aggressively hateful towards dissident opinions and people who would dare to practice their freedom of thought and speech. It's just like night and day from 2007 to 2020. And I can actually give you an example of this using CNN alone. CNN, back when you're talking about, and I think you can see it on some of those clips you mentioned on YouTube, that they would introduce me as a conservative talk radio host, which, by for all intents and purposes, that's exactly what I am. They would introduce me that way, or introduce me as James Edwards, host of the Political Cesspool. Now, CNN, the same network, 4 years ago, I can remember white supremacist James Edwards. Now, they wouldn't have me back on to talk, but they would talk about us. White supremacist James Edwards tweets support for Mike Pence's debate performance. I can remember my wife calling me in saying there's a panel on CNN talking about your tweet about something Pence had said. Now, this was back in 2016, which we got a lot of a lot of press in 2016 for the fact that Donald Trump's campaign had given me press credentials, and we had press credentials as press to go and cover the Republican National Convention, and we had interviewed Donald Trump Jr., and so they really tried to tie us to the Trump campaign. We really didn't have any contact with them at all, except for the fact that we would apply for press credentials, and those press credentials were granted. But they certainly tried to marry us to the Trump campaign and vice versa. And we were denounced by Hillary Clinton that year, and we were denounced even by the Trump campaign. But even as recently as last year, CNN did the same thing, and I can't even remember what it was about. But it was, again, white supremacist James Edwards this and this. And I responded to the CNN article saying, well, you know, when you were having me on in 2007, you were having me on to speak specifically my mind on these so-called taboo issues, because you knew I would be willing to do that. But I was always introduced as a conservative. Now I'm being introduced as a white supremacist. Nothing changed. I've certainly not changed on any of the issues. So what did change? And that's just, of course, the treatment and the slurs that are used to define people like us.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, and it goes to a point that I've talked about repeatedly on my program and I've written about. It's like the weaponization of our political discourse. And you actually, you know, you wrote a book all about this, basically, about the word racism. Your book is called Racism Smashism: How Liberals Use the R Word to Push the Obama Agenda. And I just bought it, actually. You wrote this back in, I think it was 2010, it was published, right?
That's correct.
So it was like right after Obama got elected, a couple years after Obama got elected anyways. And it's a great book. I'm about halfway through it. I just got it about a week ago. And, you know, I'm a pretty busy person. So I've been trying to get through it. I wanted to read the whole thing before we had the podcast. But
well, I'm honored you've read half of it.
Yeah. I'm actually, let me see really quick. I'm on chapter 9, I think. Yeah. So I'm about halfway through. I was actually just reading it earlier this morning before we started the podcast. But there's a couple in your book is great. I mean, you know, it's so funny because like our ideas are so timeless. Like you wrote this back in 2010, and some of the stuff you say in here is like so appropriate for what we see right now, and probably even more so. In fact, you say here in chapter 6, and I wanted to start out with this. Chapter 6, the title is Racism, It's Everywhere. And of course, you know, we see this nonsense today everywhere, this idea that racism is oppressing all these people, and, you know, white supremacy, institutional racism, you know, blacks are being oppressed by whites, blah, blah, blah. You know, we could go on about this. But, and you know, you say it so distinctly and so clearly. And again, this is 2010, you're writing this. You say here, a racist is a white person. Racist equals white person, and white person equals racist. All white people are racist, and they're always racist, and they always will be racist. Period. And, I mean, it's just, you know, a short excerpt of this, you know, longer chapter, obviously, but it's so perfect. That's exactly what we see today. And it's an example of the weaponization of our political discourse with a word like racist. And a major theme of the book is how Republicans have always cowered in the face of being called a racist. And I think Donald Trump changed a lot of that. But previously, I mean, you look at like John McCain's campaign, Mitt Romney's campaign, you know, they would cower in fear over being, you know, denounced as a racist or being alleged to be a racist or whatever. So I think it was interesting. I think it's very appropriate for what's going on today, certainly.
Well, thank you so much, John, for saying that. That was a fun thing to do. That book came out in June of 2010, and it had, you know, relatively speaking, a good deal of success. And because I found it to be, I thought it to be so timely in terms of its it aged well. We've actually run some ads in your very own Barnes Review the last couple of issues and gotten a great response. We ran an ad in American Free Press on the heels, or rather just in advance of the election. I thought it would be important to try to get some copies of this book out again, because today, more than ever, we're seeing the tenets of that book really coming to fruition. And
it's so obvious, too. That's the thing. Like, you wrote this, you know, almost 10 years ago. And it's so obviously on display right now, right? Like, literally every single day.
Well, so the general theme of the book it stands up still today. It's evergreen. And that is that in the passage you just read, it's meant to beat into the minds of our people that they are going to call you a racist no matter what. So forget the way that you think the word is defined. The way the media uses it means you're a white person. When you hear that you are a racist, that's the media's way of calling you a white person. But it has been very effective in that, and we put a lot of examples in that book. That's the part of the book that is a little bit dated, and that is, of course, I was drawing from examples at the time of the writing. So we talk about the McCain versus Obama election and the Tea Party and how the Tea Party was effectively neutered because once they started leveling the R word at them, they knew it's been time tested and battle proven that if you call a conservative a racist, he will either completely surrender and retreat from the intellectual battlefield, or he'll just spend his entire time spinning his wheels trying to explain away why he's not a racist and why the Democrats are the real racists. And either way, they lose. So the entire purpose of the book is to basically serve as a key to unlock this socio-political nuclear bomb that we've got that has only gotten infinitely worse in the subsequent decades since the writing of that book. But yes, indeed, I wrote it because white people need to understand that this is just a ploy that the left and the media uses it. You have to understand that if you get involved and you're not completely on board with the narrative, you are going to be called all of these things and worse. Racist is one of them, but of course, white supremacist, neo-Nazi, I mean, you name it. If you can think it, they'll call you that. And that's probably been the best thing that Donald Trump has given us, is that he has really been impervious to that for all of his faults. And he has good weeks and bad weeks. He had a great week a couple of weeks ago when he was talking about the anti-whiteism is canceled, and he was going on about the critical race theory, and he talked about the 1619 Project being defunded and defunding schools that taught that anti-white narrative. Great week. And then he, you know, kind of drops the ball in Atlanta with this platinum plan for blacks. But the greatest thing about Trump to me is that, well, he has been called these things every day, every single day since he descended from that escalator in 2015. And I think surely people see it now that, you know, these words are meaningless now. They have been used so often that it should have completely lost its sting, at least in the minds of people. Obviously, you still get fired. There's still some very real repercussions that could happen. But the charge itself, what, I'm a racist? Well, what, I'm the same as the sitting president of the United States? Once you start calling everyone up to the president of the United States these slurs, in a way, it goes a distance in proving our point. However,
right,
the people are still very, very fearful of it.
Well, yeah, and you know what? That's the thing about Trump is, I mean, I remember specifically, like distinctly, almost like we were talking about, you know, your experience at the convention. Like, I vividly remember Donald Trump on the debate stage denouncing political correctness, saying that he does not have time for total political correctness and all this, and he's, you know, calling out, you know, the invasion of our country. And this was very, very powerful. There was no other politician that was doing anything like this or saying anything like Trump was saying and acting in the way that Trump was acting. He's a very renegade, like, independent actor, although he has a lot of advisors that are, I think, leading him in the wrong direction. Another, you know, topic we can get into. But, I mean, even back then, back in 2015, 2016, there were repeated, like, allegations that Trump was a racist, he was a Nazi. They were calling him the next Adolf Hitler. In fact, just the other day, I actually have this right here on my Twitter feed, Jewish MSNBC commentator Donnie Deutsch was comparing Trump to Hitler again. What's the difference between Adolf Hitler and Donald Trump? is what he's saying. Like, broadcast to millions of people all over America and the world. So these people view him. Trump may not be, like, actually a white nationalist, like, you know, we'd hope that he would be, but he's definitely not. But he's viewed that way by the establishment, and certainly by the left-wing establishment.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true, and everything you were basically reiterating and enforcing, strengthening what I was saying about the situation that the president faces, and the extent to which people see this, and I would hope become a little more emboldened to stand up and speak out. But see, that's the thing that's missing, John, is that even though we've had these 4 years, and even though people know that this charge of racism has become increasingly ridiculous, I mean, we still don't have any institutionalized force advocating for the unique group interest of whites. I mean, yes, obviously we have different outlets, but we don't have an NAACP. We don't have even one politician, including Donald Trump, by the way, who I like Trump. I'm going to vote to reelect him. I like him overall because he upsets the apple cart, and as you mentioned, the political correctness. And I just think I'm not a lesser of two evils guy. Donald Trump, by the way, was the first Republican presidential nominee that I ever voted for. Now, I did vote for Ron Paul in the primaries, but I mean, on election day, I always voted third party on election day until Trump.
Yeah, yeah, that's me too. Yeah,
I like this. I like how he goes after political correctness. I think he says a lot of the things that we like. I don't know where that's going to go, if that's going to dissipate after he leaves office, whether it be next, you know, later this year, or rather in January, or in 4 years from now. But he is the best of the options that we have right now. There's no doubt about it. I want to buy as much time as I can. That's not a glowing endorsement because he has failed on a lot of the things that we had hoped he would accomplish, the wall being the biggest one. But he does say a lot of things that resonate in the hearts and minds of whites. Hopefully one day that will bear fruit in a way that perhaps we can't imagine now. But with regards to Biden, I mean, you're going to have complete open borders. A billion Americans. You know, there's been talk about that. A billion new Americans, perhaps. And I think with Biden, you certainly could. It wouldn't be too hard to envision European style laws criminalizing free speech. So Trump's the best we've got right now. That doesn't mean he's the guy we would create if we had the tools to manufacture the perfect candidate. But coming up quick.
Yeah, no, I totally hear you, and I agree. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you just compare Trump's speech at the RNC where he was accepting, you know, the nomination for president for the party versus what O'Biden said. I mean, these people, like the Democrats, like openly hate America. They openly hate, especially white people. Like, they make no bones about this. They want to totally destroy the economy. They're very radical. I mean, they support and endorse Black Lives Matter and all these riots going on across the country. I mean, it could not be more clear, like, which side you should be supporting. And that doesn't mean that Trump is perfect. I totally agree with you. I mean, I think he's got a lot of potential. I think he could do big things.
Well, see, that's the thing, I think. I mean, there's always the off chance that Trump will deliver a haymaker. But, you know, even
and
Trump,
and,
though,
and you know what, James, he easily could is what I'm like. That's why I'm so dumbfounded. Like, he has the political support. If he just came out and said some of the things that we're saying, it's going to resonate.
Well,
with
he
people.
Came very and, close. He came. Listen, I mean, you go back, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago? It wasn't very long ago. He came very close. I mean, he retweeted the Columbia, whatever, Bugle or whatever it is, saying anti-white 101 is canceled. I mean, he's got about as close as anybody could, and that's the thing. We don't have one politician. And even Trump won't specifically say what I'm going to do for white voters, you know, the people who actually vote for him. We saw him in Atlanta a couple of days ago saying, you know, this plan for Black America, $500 trillion for Black businesses. And
yeah,
you know,
yeah, I got an article up here right about it, yeah.
A lot of crazy stuff, but you know, I'll tell you what's going on there if anybody wants to know. He rolled that out in Georgia because Georgia's becoming a purple state because of immigration and because of the way that whites are being browbeaten to consider themselves not to be good people unless they hate themselves. And in order to prove that they hate themselves, they need to vote for the guy that's going to harm them the most, and that's Biden. There's a lot of that going on. But because Georgia's in play, I think, you know, cynically, I don't think Trump's really going to give $500 billion. I mean, where'd that number come from? But I think he's thinking, hey, you want reparations? Here's $500 billion. Reelect me. In Georgia, if he can move, you got to understand how close some of these states are. We remember going back even to 2000 where Al Gore beat, or rather it was a 500 vote difference between Gore and Bush in Florida, 500 votes out of millions cast. And even between Trump and Hillary, there were several states that teetered on a razor's edge, a knife's edge. I think there were some states with just a few thousand votes out of millions cast, a few thousand separating. So in a state like Georgia, if Trump can come into Atlanta and say, I'm going to give you $500 billion to reelect me, blacks, if he can get his black vote total in Georgia up from 2% to 3%, that may be enough to carry the state and keep it red. So, you know, all of that. But, yeah, again, with regard to Trump, we do need somebody. I wish we would have somebody that says, this is what I'm going to do for white Americans. And of course, we don't have that, but that's as close as we're going to get. So we got to go with the closest we can get.
I hear you and I agree with you. And I mean, it's to me, the thing about Trump, that the most important thing about Trump is that he's making this all very, very clear. This is not some secret. It's like on display every single day, vividly. You know, like literally every day, like you turn on the media and he's being denounced as a racist. And that's a big part of your book is just, you know, racism and the word racism and racist are literally like the most weaponized terms in our political discourse. And, you know, you think about like anti-Semite or anti-Semitism or conspiracy theory. It's right. Like all of them are right up there and they're just used to demonize people that think critically. And, you know, can actually, like, think for themselves, I guess, is really what it boils down to. But your book really kind of goes into all of this and explains all of this very, very well. And, it's totally appropriate for exactly what's going on today.
Well, it was written also in a way that can be understood by anyone. So it wasn't written for people who, I mean, obviously, people who regularly listen to my show, you know, a great number of them have the book and they enjoy it. But it's certainly written for someone as well who doesn't have a very good understanding about the way these things work and perhaps are confused and about it. So it's written on a very introductory level. And it's something, though, it's something that people who do have a firm grasp of understanding on our issues can appreciate, maybe get a laugh out of. It was written. That's another thing, too. I mean, the left hates to be mocked. And so we wrote it in a lighthearted way, serious, but there's some you know, there's some humor in it as well, but it's also written as something you can give as a gift to a woebegone conservative or even a moderate liberal, and it shouldn't offend them too much. It's really something that everybody can get something out of.
Oh,
so
no,
it's a good gift for somebody that you might want to bring in.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And I mean, I think the main point is that the word racist is really just like an average white person, especially somebody that's racially conscious or cares about white interests and history and culture, and certainly one that seeks to advance white interests politically, socially, or economically. But, I mean, at the end of the day, like a racist is a white person, according to the media, according to the leftist establishment. And unless we're willing to confront that and be brave about it and say, hey, look, call me a racist, whatever, like, we're never going to get anywhere, right?
No, that's right. Well, and actually, that's how I closed the book. So you've got something to look forward to there. That's exactly right. That's exactly how I ended the book. I mean, we cannot take these charges seriously. We have to laugh at them and then counterattack. I mean, but this whole thing that we've been doing in the conservative movement is like the liberals of 5 minutes ago. The conservatives have not won anything ever in my lifetime. They have never been able to stop any radical egalitarian advancement And this is a big reason why. It's because they accept the left's premise that, you know, their ancestors were bad. Well, yeah, they were racist because they put their families first. But we're not like that. We're more enlightened, and, you know, race doesn't have anything to do with it. Well, you know, the hell it doesn't. Race has everything to do with it. Every group of people have their own unique interests. They have their own histories and cultures and heroes and languages and faiths and all of these things that make them distinct. And whites want to have this sort of inverted white supremacy, really, by saying, well, everybody else has identity politics, but we're better than that. And so we're going to go out and show how superior we are by voting, you know, to help the other instead of our own families, which is obviously sickening and counterintuitive and silly. But again, the book helps people get beyond that and get back right in the, keep it between the ditches. And it's something I'm very proud of. So it's, again, with it being a decade old, there's not many times I can come on a show and talk about it. So this is certainly a great treat to be able to revisit it here and now.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. It's definitely worth reading. I mean, it's a great book. I've been reading it the past week since I got it, and it's outstanding. And you know, that actually you kind of addressed my next question, which was what is an effective way to deal with being called a racist or a white supremacist? I mean, I've had to deal with this, you know, in my own personal life countless times. I mean, I've been a public figure, you know, saying these things for over 10 years. And, you know, I've had problems with jobs and with, you know, all sorts of other personal situations. But I think it's an interesting question. And for somebody like you, you know, you're basically in the same position I've been in for well longer than I have. So how do you deal with it? How do you explain these things to people, or like, I don't know, I guess try to demystify the word racist. Like, how would you tackle that?
Well, again, you don't even want to spend a lot of time answering the charge, because that's what so many people do, and it just keeps them spinning their wheels and explaining it away and debating. I mean, the left, I don't think really, I mean, maybe some do. I think a lot of them just know it's just such an effective way to rout any opposition by leveling these terms. That they don't care if they believe it to be true or not. All they got to do is hurl it out there and you're done for. So I don't know if I've ever really, I mean, as we say, even liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats, if there is such a thing, I mean, every white person is called a racist by default anyway. Now, if you are somebody, one of the rare people who does publicly take up the torch for white advocacy, I mean, you're certainly a racist and so much more. You're a racist than a, as you mentioned, white supremacist, neo-Nazi, anti-Semite. You're all of that in one sentence.
when
you read the report. So, I, you know, in all the press we've gotten, I don't know if I've ever answered the charge or not. I can't remember. I mean, we certainly give some advice in the book for it, but I don't think I've ever gotten into a discussion with a reporter or any interviewer as to whether I am or am not these things. I just basically let them call me whatever they want to call me and then lay out what I do believe. And of course, what I do believe is that I love my family. I love my extended family, which I consider our race to be. And it's certainly not bad something worthy of a denunciation if any other race, color, creed stands up for who they are and champions their culture. And so I'm going to do that for my people. And I don't think it's anything wrong at all. In fact, I think it's very natural and healthy.
Exactly. Well, and I think the main thing is not to go on the defensive.
Exactly.
Not to be like, oh, look, you know, yeah, I'm white.
You're exactly right. The one thing I would say that you certainly don't want to do is say, well, I'm not a racist. I mean, maybe you're not, okay? I mean, but that, it just gives the whole thing, if you deny, and it just gives their whole, you know,
it lends
their
credence.
Whole attack validity.
It lends credence, exactly, yeah. Well, and
so
that's,
I would just
that's
say what I just said. No, I love my people. I'm proud of my heritage. I'm not going to deny my ancestors. I want my ancestors to be proud of me. I want to live a life that they would be proud of. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's natural and healthy. You do that, you feel really empowered. You that's how you counterattack. You don't give the charge any credence whatsoever. No, this is what I am. It's natural. It's healthy. Anybody who doesn't believe what I just said, there's something wrong with them. They've got the problem, not me. I will not apologize. Now, I have said that over and over. And in fact, the first time we ever made national news in the capacity of the political cesspool, we had been put on the hate watch list. This was just a few months after we first went on the air. This is when so many people, now anybody can have a certain amount, anyone can detest watching a weakling go on TV or give a quote to a newspaper reporter. I'm not a racist. I apologize for this misunderstanding. There's no place in society for this. And just all the standard boilerplate stuff we see people who are charged with the R word, how they respond. And, you know, our thing on the radio program, our motto has always been no retreat, no surrender, no apology. But unless you've actually walked through that fire, I don't know how much authority you have to tell other people what you would do if you were in that situation, because you don't know until you've been in that situation. Well, we've been in that situation many, many, many times. But I do remember the first time, a few months after we first went on the air, we get labeled a hate group. All of the local media is wanting to do a story on it. It made national news. NBC called me. They said they wanted to meet with me. They wanted to sit down and get my response. Now, that is when 99 white men out of 100 say, I'm not a racist. I love everybody. My best friend's black. This, that, and the other. And just completely emasculates and embarrasses themselves. And by the way, when you do that, number one, you lose any credibility you have as a leader or a spokesman when you play that game. That's number one. And the left doesn't care. They don't say, oh, well, we had you all wrong. You're a good guy. No, they still write the story that you're all these things that we're going to call you to begin with. And you don't curry any favor with them. And you just look like exactly what you are, a weakling. So I sat down with NBC and they said, well, what's your reaction to being labeled a hate group leader? And I said, you know, I'm ecstatic that this happened. I'm ecstatic that I'm on the hate watch list. You have not arrived as a leader for, I can't remember exactly what I said, for your cause or the conservative cause or whatever, until you've been put there. I'm ecstatic. I want a group of communists and civil rights hustlers to identify me as the exact opposite of them. This is a great day. And when you do that, they don't own you. There's nothing that they can do with you when you do that. And that's the way men have to stand up and do it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know what? Before, like, leading up to this podcast, I was going back and, like, just reviewing how I handled the situation with my whole, I don't know, I wouldn't call it a doxing, but basically, you know, a reporter contacted the city that I was working for, and I reviewed some of the things that I said, and, like, I totally am, like, so proud of myself for just doubling down. Should be. And, yeah, and, like, not backing down. And that's the thing, like, people, like, especially the Republicans, and I mean, again, going back to your book, that's the main point, is that the Republicans, until Trump anyways, have just always backed down and cowered in fear of being called racist or whatever other slur, you know, political slur they could throw at people. And that's got to change. And I think that's why Trump won, actually, is because he did not back down.
And he still has it. I mean, there's been some good things he's done. There's been some bad things. There's been some things that he said that you would not get out of any other person in elected office, all the way down to your local no-name town alderman. But then there's some things he says that leaves you scratching your head. But the one thing that he has been consistent with is that he's always stuck it right back to the media. And it just incenses them.
Oh, it incenses absolutely, them.
But he has set an example of how you can stand up and not apologize. And I think, again, that's been a net gain for him. And by the way,
a net gain for conservatism and, like, the Republican Party more broadly, I think.
Well, yeah, for sure. But unfortunately, there's not a lot of Republicans with the same backbone. But the whole thing about this apology, this groveling that we see so many people do when they are attacked as these things. Number one, as I said a moment ago, the apology never helps you. You still You still get discarded. You still get whatever's coming is coming. And the apology very rarely saves you.
It does make you look weak.
But you have nothing to apologize for. If you have nothing to apologize for, why would you issue an apology? But so many white people do it. That's why it's so important that we have people like you, people like the people we collaborate with, who are going to set that example. Somebody's got to set the example. I wish it was people with a lot more talent than me, but it's been a wonderful life. It's been a wonderfully turbulent life. I mean, it's difficult to go out and take these slings and arrows, but it really does pale in comparison to the sacrifice of blood and bone that men far greater than us did in sacrifice and service to this country. So, in comparison to them, we're lucky that we only get called names because a lot of them died for it.
I'm willing to die. Yeah, I was going to say, this is a hill I am willing to die on. I am not going to be cowered into submission. I'm not going to be degraded. We're right, and we're going to stand up and say what's right until I take my last dying breath.
Amen. Amen.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, if it comes to that, it comes to that. But, you know, certainly I would like to live for my cause as well and fight for my cause. But as we are doing, and we'll do that for as long as we can, and we don't know what the future is going to hold. I would, of course, advise everyone listening to not do anything that's illegal, to not advocate for things that are illegal, to not do anything in private or on the phone or on the street that you wouldn't do in front of an FBI agent or a judge or whatever. That's just a good rule of thumb. But that's not to say that, you know, they can get you for anything, I guess. And if that time comes, then we have to be men and willing to accept it, but never give them a reason to do that. And I've always tried to live my life that way in my activism. And if and when the day comes where speech is outlawed here, free speech is outlawed here like it is in the UK and elsewhere in the Western world, then we'll all have an interesting decision to make.
James, we're at a point now where, I mean, moms, like football moms, are being arrested for not wearing a mask at a football game.
Yeah, I saw that.
I mean, give me a break. This isn't even political. This is just like trying to enjoy your life and like watch your kid play sports. You know what I mean? Like it's not even like forget about the political stuff. Like everything that we're dealing with right now, especially with this COVID, you know, nonsense. I mean, it's impacting everybody on a way that's above politics. It's literally like it's our lives. It's like your experienced reality, and you have to make a stand.
We could have certainly gone an hour on COVID alone. I mean, my goodness, I can't even begin to think how much time we spent on that over the course of this year on our own program. But now this has been one hell of a year. I mean, we haven't even touched on the rioting and the constant insurrection and the rampant lawlessness in city after city. And that's, you know, that's interesting too, because I mean, people ask and it's a good question. I mean, Trump is the president, right? I mean, why haven't we seen National Guards go in? And you've got, I mean, here we are concerned, about being arrested for exercising our First Amendment right. But you've got members
or for not wearing a mask
or not wearing a mask or anything exactly outrageous like that. But you've got members of terrorist groups like Antifa and Black Lives Matter. They shot two cops in one night in Louisville earlier this week.
They are still allowed
to possess the streets. They are still blocking traffic and engaging in hooliganism and arson and vandalism and breaking out windows and all of the stuff that they've been doing all year. Why hasn't Trump completely shut that down? And it could be shut down so quickly. It could be shut down so easily, but you have to have some sort of, you have to meet force with force, not just people who are there to sort of monitor. I've seen National Guard there just sort of standing around watching, not really doing anything.
Well, in many cases, they're actually like bowing down and like supporting the Black Lives Matter movement.
I've seen
you've seen videos of this. Like,
That was more prevalent, I think, in the early weeks of this whole thing. Back in May and June, you saw cops doing that. I think, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter scam has actually lost a whole lot of public appeal, a lot of public support. And it's amazing that it had any from anyone to begin with, but their numbers are way down. But I'm just saying, Trump could have stopped this. Now, he is the president. He's Mr. Law and Order. Well, why hasn't he stopped it? But, you know, to be fair, and it's a good question, it's gone on all year. But to be fair, you know, it is happening in Democratic-controlled cities and states for the most part. And, of course, the Democratic mayors and governors could have certainly stopped it as well, and they're not doing it either. At some point, though, I guess it has to stop, right? I mean, how long can you let your country just its cities be taken by a mob? We're, what, now 6 months in?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, think about Portland. I mean, Seattle. Like, these cities are destroyed. At least, like, the downtown core areas. I mean, could you imagine trying to run a business down there with all this going on?
No, and COVID on top of it, you know. With
the, yeah, exactly. It's like the 1-2 punch.
There's nothing. I mean, they're for equality. I mean, this whole thing about police brutality, the so-called, and we know what racist means, right? You know, we've been talking about that. So these racist cops just cruising around in their squad cars waiting for, you know, an innocent black man to kill. There is no evidence whatsoever. And in fact, any statistics that any critical research you could gin up proves the exact opposite, that blacks aren't targeted, aren't victims of police shootings or anything like that, any more or less than anyone else, based upon different, you know, sets of data. And so that whole thing,
it's all a fraud. Yeah.
Doesn't exist. and what equality they are given, you want to talk about privilege, the privilege to sack cities, to be able to do whatever you want to do, whatever crime almost you want to commit, and not have anybody push back on that. What equality are they marching for? Blacks have preferential treatment in terms of affirmative action, scholarships, job opportunities. They're moved to the head of the line. They can vote. They can eat at the lunch counter. They can do anything they want to do. If anything, they are favored. I for the life of me, and I try to see both sides, I cannot understand what in the world they are protesting about. The people who died, where you're talking about people who resisted arrest,
and the case drug dealers, Floyd, yeah, on drug drugs. Dealers.
I mean, you're talking
about
petty criminals to a person. The Breonna Taylor thing, she was neck deep in drug trafficking. She was not in bed. She was in the hall, based upon what I've seen, what I've read. Her boyfriend was firing at the cops. She got caught in the crossfire.
And they actually knocked. It was not a no-knock
raid. It was a
no-knock,
and they knocked.
See, that's the thing. Like, everything is so – it's literally, like, the exact opposite. Like, every last thing with all of these cases is literally the exact opposite. I mean, it's incredible.
Well, the only thing is – so, right. I mean, we've established that the whole thing is a farce, and above and beyond the individual cases of these petty criminals having an accident because they resisted arrest or they were involved in wrongdoing or their boyfriend was shooting at cops or whatever, or they were on drugs or a combination of all of that. The only thing I can see is it's just a pure, unadulterated hatred of white people.
Absolutely.
And of this country.
That's what it boils down to.
That would motivate these people to go out. And if you let people who are inclined to carnage run free, well, they're doing it because it's a good time. And do you think they really
because
care?
They're getting away with it. Exactly. They're getting away with it.
BLM thug cares about George Floyd. No, it's just that they're getting kicks. This is fun. They
I remember seeing a video of a black thug in Santa Monica, California, that was actually arrested. I mean, he probably got let off. Got let off after he got apprehended. But he's being interviewed by a local media station, and he says, "Nah, I don't care about George Floyd. I'm just here to loot. I'm just here to steal." And I mean, like, this is like happening all over the country. This is exactly their mindset. And it's just incredible. And I want to read. I know we're getting ready to wrap up the program, but there's one more excerpt of your book I want to read, And this actually comes from Chapter 7, Idiocracy. It's not just a movie. And Idiocracy is one of my favorite movies. Mike Judge, I think, is the director. He's the same guy that does The Simpsons, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And you say here, we're allowing the least intelligent among us to use political correctness and the ever-present but unmentioned threat of riots to dictate what we can and can't do, say, or even think. And every day, the straitjacket we've allowed them to strap us into gets tighter and tighter. And this is talk about exactly what's going on today. It's like a whole other level today, though.
Wow, that was a good excerpt you pulled there. I don't even remember. You know, it's been a few years.
Page 43 from the book.
I could write
yeah.
good 10 years ago. There you go.
Oh, but no, it's brilliant.
Course,
yeah.
That's true. that's obviously true. Yeah, I mean, the inmates are running the asylum. The least worthy. I mean, and this goes all the way up to the elites, by the way. The wicked should not be honored. And we see Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So it goes all the way up from the bottom up. But, the people that deserve it the least are the ones that, really everybody's bowing to and catering to all the way
well,
up. That, in
well,
some
yeah,
ways.
That's the thing. Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, even with Trump lately, with his pandering to the blacks in Georgia. But, I guess at some point it has to end. I don't know what happens after this election. If Donald Trump and the Republicans don't get a handle on immigration, though, you know, we talked about this in 2016, it could have already been too far gone. And then in 2018, in the midterm, the Republicans won those critical states like Florida by an even lesser margin than Donald Trump carried it in 2016 and in 2018. So you've got another 2 years since the midterms. You've let out all these criminals that are going to be straight ticket Democratic voters with that Prison Reform Act. You've got, more immigration over the course of the last 2 to 4 years, straight ticket Democrats. And if Trump loses Florida, the election's over at about 8 p.m. Eastern time. You can go ahead and go to bed. You're not going to be waiting up until 1 o'clock in the morning like we did with Hillary. It's going to be a very early night.
You think so? So like Florida's like the key state, you think?
Well, if he loses Florida, which he won last time, I mean, Florida's, 25 electoral votes? That's a 50 electoral vote swing. I don't see a path if he loses a state that big.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see. Shoot, I mean, it's like, less than 6 weeks away.
Well,
I'm curious to see how the debate is going to go on Tuesday.
I cannot wait for that. I am actually really surprised, to be honest with you, that they are going to allow Joe Biden to debate in light of his obvious cognitive decline. I mean, it's not just here and there. It's nearly every time he speaks now. There's some form of mental slip up. And
oh, yeah. It's very, very obvious. Yeah. yeah. And Trump, exactly. Trump is the opposite. Trump is still sharp as he was in 2016.
He's sharp. He's not much younger, but he's certainly got the vigor of a much younger man. And Biden, even though he's only a couple of years older than Trump, is certainly acting as someone who's much older, appearing as someone who is much older. So that is going to be must see TV, unless they have an ear an earplug in that Biden can use where somebody can tell him the answers and he repeats what he hears. I just don't see him holding up in an hour long, supposedly unscripted debate. I mean, I'm sure that the candidates will know the questions that are coming, but without a teleprompter, it'll be very interesting. And if Biden does as poorly as I think he might, it's going to be amazing to see how he holds up. I mean, even people who I don't think the people who would vote for Biden would necessarily vote for Trump under any circumstances that they can be won over. But if Biden just does so ridiculously poorly, he could discourage people from turning out, maybe. I don't know. But in either way, whatever the eventuality would be, I am certainly looking forward to watching that on Tuesday. That's the day after tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
For anyone
listening
live.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be interesting for sure. And, Yeah, James, I'll tell you what, we'll wrap up. I appreciate you coming on my program. And, you know, I certainly appreciate you supporting the Barnes Review. You got a nice ad in the Barnes Review. And I'm going to have a link over to purchase your book directly from your website, which I would encourage people to do to support your work. So,
well, we've
thanks,
definitely
man.
Got
yeah.
some here. We'd be happy to send those out to anybody who wants them. And, John, again, I mean it from the bottom of my heart. The honor was all mine. Really love your work with American Free Press and Barnes Review, and look forward to our next collaboration already.
Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon.
You got it. Have a great night. Godspeed.
All right. You too.